Welcome to the talk show dedicated to the wine industry. It's All About Wine. With your host, winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call our guest line at any time during the live show at area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is educate people and make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com from coast to coast.
Basser, Kansas.
Deming, New Mexico.
Ithaca, New York.
Knoxville.
Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Montana.
Moscow, Idaho.
New Hampshire.
New Mexico.
Santa Rosa.
Sevierville, Tennessee.
South Dakota.
The coast of Maine.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Westport, Mass.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. Alba Vineyards.
Blog.10Live.
Boyflip Winery.
Brotherhood.
Camas Prairie Winery.
Candia Vineyards.
Pelo de Borghese.
Eagle Springs Winery.
Flathead Lake Winery.
Free the Grapes.
Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery.
Hershey Harrisburg Wine Country.
Holy Field Vineyard and Winery.
Hummingbird Ridge Winery.
Joy Soy of Wine.
Prairie Berry.
Rainborn Wines.
Rocky Top Wine Trail.
Sheila Lauder Vineyards and Winery.
Southwest Wine.
Haber Hill.
Ten Spoon.
University of Kentucky Extension.
Vineyard at Hershey.
Vibach Winery.
Walt Vineyard.
Westport Rivers.
Wine Flower.
And around the world.
TheDriftingWineMaker.com.
Dunkle.biz.
I just arrived in Bali about 3 days ago.
All About Wine is on.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
We do occasionally get off topic.
Del Boar Winery.
The most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest.
I've heard voices at the winery.
Call area code 646-727-3235 and let's talk about wine on air. And now, wine enthusiast and industry representatives, All About Wine is on. Here is your host, Ron.
Yeah, it is nice.
Yeah. Beautiful weather. Beautiful weather. And it's supposed to be beautiful all the way through until next, I don't know, Tuesday or Wednesday of next week.
Huh.
So, yeah.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, I'm looking at that website you showed me, and it's cool. You can pull up a map of, like I pulled up a map of Texas. I've got to check it out, but there's a winery right at DFW Airport.
Oh,
I gotta look into that. La Bodega Winery. I'll see if that's an actual winery or just a store, and they called it a winery. I don't know.
And sometimes they sneak that in, but most of the time they're wineries.
Yeah, I like that map view because I can see where we're going to be at, and all these little things pop up. The show's going. So anyway,
it tells you what's close and all that too. We're talking about the website catchwine.com. It really is a good sign if you're traveling around the country. If you're going to another state or something like that, it is fantastic because you can pinpoint where you're going, what you're going to visit and stuff, and then find wineries all around that area.
There's quite a few. I was making a joke about Grapevine. If I can't find a winery in Grapevine or whatever, there's a problem because they misnamed the town. But I can zoom in, and there's a whole bunch of those little pegs at Grapevine just north of Dallas-Fort Worth area. That's okay. That might be that's a good possibility there. I'll have to check into that. I did not go to work today because today is National Drink Wine Day. So
yes, it is. I had the day off also. That's why I played golf.
Okay.
So.
I didn't go that far, but I figured, today's a national holiday, so I'm taking it off, and there you go.
I played golf and...
Yeah,
wine.
Awesome.
National Wine Day.
Great day for golf, I'm sure.
It was a little bit windy, but it was gorgeous out there for golf. You know, you didn't, unlike Florida golfing where you have a everything is soaking wet because of the temperature and humidity. It was really nice today. So.
Yeah. Well, we're talking, we're going to have a guest tonight from Palisade, Colorado, and it is 57 degrees there now. Very low humidity, I guess, for there is 45%, and a 27 mile per hour wind.
Oh, that's pretty heavy. Now, and our guest from there, I pulled up Verizon Vineyards and Winery on Ketch Wine, and the Ketch Wine also tastes what wineries are close to wherever you are, so you can, if you want to visit other ones. And on this, Confire Cellars is 0.4 of a mile away from Verizon. St. Catherine Cellars is 0.4 of a mile away. Grand River Vineyards is 0.4 of a mile away. Corley Vineyards is 0.5 of a mile away, half mile away, and Plum Creek Winery is 0.7 of a mile away. So,
wow.
I know there's five of them right here, less than a mile away.
Are they maybe a wine trail or something, or is it?
I don't have to ask him. I don't know. You would think, you would hope so, with them that close. You can almost walk to them all in one day. So.
Absolutely. Let me go grab him. We'll find out.
All right. Very good. Very good. No. Mike will be back with us here in just a second while he goes and grabs Alex West of Verizon Vineyards and Winery, located in Palisade, Colorado. Alex is the lab man, and he's educated at University of California at Davis. He has spent a year in France extending that education and making wines. Now he is back, and his dad, Ron, and Alex are the, I guess, the proprietors of Verizon Vineyard. They have a tasting room, a full service at Varietos, 11 acres of grapes. So they are in an AVA, Grand Valley AVA. So we will get them on and talk to them about, or talk to him about Verizon Vineyards. He said she's also something they do at the winery of Verizon Vineyards and Winery is tell people an advanced little thing to tasting wines and what to look for and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say about that. So it should be interesting. It should be fun. And we'll get him on here and we'll talk about how a little bit of his education and about Verizon Winery. Oh, it looks like he's in the green room. Let's go ahead and bring him in now. Yeah, I think. There we go. Hello, Alex. Welcome to
All
About
Wine. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're able to join us tonight. I was just telling him a little bit about your education. UC Davis, and then you're in France. What area of France were you in?
I was actually in Sancerre, which is a winemaking region about an hour and a half south of Paris. It's kind of at the head of the Loire Valley. They're famous for their Sancerre White, which is a really nice Sauvignon Blanc that really, it's unmatched anywhere in the world. It's completely different than New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or any other style. So it was a privilege and an honor to learn how to make that style while I was over there.
That sounds fascinating. I have the newest edition of Wines and Vines directory, 2016 directory. I was looking at this for you guys here. Is Ron your dad?
Ron is my father, and he's the executive wine master and the proprietor of the facility at Verizon.
Okay.
So it is a family business.
Well, tell us a little bit of history leading up to Verizon Vineyards and Winery. What started it? Why? And also your fantastic old building that you have the winery in.
Absolutely. Well, we'll kind of start the story at the beginning. Our family is, we're fifth generation in the Grand Valley area, Grand Junction area in Colorado. We've been there since the 1890s. And originally we were a farming family, and we raised cattle, and our family worked for the railroad for an extended period of time. My father went to college and got a degree as a chemist and a biochemist and a degree in microbiology. And after his stint in college, he had the opportunity to work with a couple of startup companies developing analytical chemistry techniques for looking at fluids, looking at water, and looking at electrolytes and different things of interest in liquids around the world. And one of his major global clients was the burgeoning Napa Valley wine industry in the 1980s. And the companies with whom he was working were charged with the development of figuring out what made certain wines taste the way they did and how do you replicate that year after year after year. You know, consistency is really the name of the game. And so he was charged with figuring out how do you make an oaky, buttery Chardonnay and why does mine taste different than my neighbor's and what if I like my neighbor's? Could I replicate his and could I make that way? And, you know, realistically, the California wine industry is run at this point by five major companies that really produce very, very good drinkable quality bottles of wine, and they're consistently the same year after year after year. I mean, if you pick up any major label of wine from the Napa Valley, you already know what you're going to get. There will be no vast or amazing surprises, and you're going to be pleased with it every single time. They do that to minimize the number of variables and to minimize the number of mistakes that are made in the winemaking process. And after working for 17 years in Napa doing quality assurance, quality control work for the wine industry, we had a piece of property that the county decided that they wanted to zone in a different way. They wanted to take it from the agricultural zoning, and they wanted to put houses on it. And we said, you know, it's time for us to do something. So we said, you know, it shouldn't be that big of a deal. We've worked on the chemistry end of making wine. Why don't we plant some grapes? And so we planted our first vineyard in 2001 in the Grand Valley in Grand Junction. And for the first couple of years, grapes take a few years to develop before any major crop comes out of it. And we sold the first crop and figured out that there is absolutely no money in raising grapes. So we said, you know, we'll start a winery and we'll start kind of from the other end of things. We'll utilize our knowledge in chemistry, biochemistry, and microbiology, and really attack winemaking from a very scientific point of view. And so in 2005, we purchased a home of a family friend in the middle of downtown Palisade, which is the part of the wine-growing region on the western slope, and planted an additional 8 acres of grapes around that, and renovated a 100-year-old brick Victorian home and turned that into the tasting room for the winery with offices and a residence up above, and then a tasting room in the original parlor area of the 5,800-square-foot house. So it's been we're really in the job of maintaining the past for the future and not getting rid of the heritage in western Colorado. We really wanted the feel to be very different from a lot of the other wineries that I've experienced both in Colorado and really around the world. You know, we wanted to get away from the straight metal building, here's the barrels, here's the tanks, try the wine, said, and really provide an education and an experience to every single one of our guests that visit us. So in 2004, we purchased the property and started the redevelopment, and we built a 6,800-square-foot winery building and an entertainment pavilion for doing everything from weddings and receptions to birthday parties to we host a lot of international tour groups as well for dinners, and we do a lot of catered events. So we're very much involved in the entertainment business as much as we are involved in the wine production side of things in western Colorado.
I was talking right before you, Mike, when gotcha. You're located in Palisade. There is a lot of wineries around there.
There are indeed. And actually, there are a lot of wineries in the state of Colorado. You know, we don't usually think of Colorado as a burgeoning agricultural community, but there are currently, last time I checked, there are 106 licensed wineries in the state. And a majority of those are on the western slope. We're approximately halfway between Denver and Salt Lake. So we're 3.5 hours from Denver west on I-70, approximately 40 miles from the Utah border, in an absolutely pristine high desert valley. And we have a very high amount of sunlight, warm summers, cool winters, not exceptionally cold. They have been the last couple of years, but, you know, weather's screwy wherever you go in the United States. And so we generally see about 182-day growing season, and we get approximately 72% of those days are bright, sunny days with very high-intensity sunlight, which is just perfect for raising good quality grapes with high sugar content and perfect flavor and canola development.
What is the highs and lows in the winter and summer there? What do you usually get on average?
On average, well, the unique thing about Colorado is that there's very little humidity. And so the temperatures, if I said it was 105 degrees and you were in South Florida and it was 105, you'd feel like you were going to die. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you'd be calling in for some kind of massive air conditioner. You know, in July, we rarely see temperatures that are over 105. That would be considered an exceptionally hot day in the middle of the summer. But anywhere from the mid-90s to the low 100s during the day. And at night, it's unique because we don't have that humidity. We have a very vast temperature swing. So although it will be 100 degrees during the day, at nighttime the temperature will fall 40 degrees, and it would not be uncommon to see temperatures in the high 50s or low 60s in the same day. So that's a very valuable trait for growing grapes. Grapes require very high, and particularly, we'll get to this in a little bit, but particularly the varietals that we've selected to have planted there require very high amounts of sunlight, very warm days, and then the cool nights allow the berries to contract back, and they actually will pull water back out of the berry, and so you'll get like this pulsation cycle that will happen, and that causes very, very flavorful, you'll get very, very strong flavors that develop in those grapes. So in the summertime, we have very warm temperatures. In the wintertime, rarely does it get below 20 degrees.
Really,
it isn't as cold as everyone expects. You know, you see the temperatures in Aspen or Vail, and it's 15 degrees below zero. That would be considered an abnormality for our area. 20 degrees is really a fairly decent average low temperature from December through February. We were at 65 degrees today, so if that tells you anything, it's a little bit off this year. But, you know, it's, once again, the weather fluctuates, and you never really know what you're going to get.
I just thought of something there. Elevation, what is your elevation there?
Our elevation is 4,700 feet, we are some of the highest grape-growing areas in the world. We have vineyards, actually, in Colorado. There's another AVA, an American Viticultural Appellation, here in Colorado called the West Elks region, and they actually grow grapes upwards of 6,000 feet. Typically Riesling and other Rhone varietals are grown at those elevations, but where we are, we're nestled next to the Colorado River, and the elevation is approximately 4,700 feet.
Oh, so the Colorado River is right there. I didn't realize it went through there.
Within a mile of our vineyards is where the river flows past. The Grand Valley is an historic lake bed, a prehistoric lake bed, and there are actually quite a few dinosaur fossils in the very surrounding areas. And the Grand Valley the soil is very, very fine sandy clay, a lot of sandy loam, and really good riverbed deposits in the bottom of the valley. And the Colorado River still flows directly through the Grand Valley on its way toward Utah and toward, distantly, Lake Powell. So it goes right through us, and that's where we get the majority of our irrigation water, is from the Colorado River. Rainfall is significantly lower than would allow for the growing of most agricultural crops. We get typically less than 19 inches of total precipitation a year, if I remember my figures correctly, which is not enough to really grow anything beyond sagebrush and greasewood. In non-irrigated areas, there is very little that grows. But in the early 1900s, a program went in that actually put a dam across the Colorado River and provided approximately 60 miles of irrigation canals that run on the high elevation all the way through the valley and provide gravity-fed irrigation water through pipes, channels, and canals to the majority of customers in Grand Valley, through Grand Junction, and out toward Fruita, Loma, and Mac. So, you know, thank goodness that they put stuff in the early 1900s. Otherwise, it would still be a desolate desert, and it would look very much look it would look like Green River, Utah, or areas that get very little precipitation, such as Moab.
Actually, the whole area counts on the Colorado for all of its water, basically, then.
It does indeed. It does indeed.
Now, so any influence from the river or to your vineyard? I mean, a lot of times, you know, rivers will give an influence to temperatures and stuff. Does it affect
right.
your vineyard?
Well, the area in which our vineyards are planted is not affected as much by the river as it is by what the river does to the climate and to the microclimate directly surrounding our vineyards. The mouth of the Grand Valley, which is where Palisade is situated, it comes out of a large canyon called Debec Canyon, and it opens into the Grand Valley. And at the narrowest point, it's less than a mile wide, and then it opens into the Great Basin out toward Utah. And so during the daytime, as the Great Basin and the sands of eastern Utah and western Colorado are warming up, as temperatures are changing based on the sun warming everything up, the wind will start to blow, and it will start blowing up toward the up valley, basically. So the wind will blow from west to east, and most of our weather patterns move from west to east in western Colorado.
Yeah.
At nighttime, when the temperature changes, the cooler air will start to flow down out of Debec Canyon and out off of the Rocky Mountains, and it will come through that one-mile-wide stretch of the valley, and it won't be a gale-force wind, but a 1 to 2 mile-an-hour wind, just enough to ruffle the leaves, will blow fairly consistently all night long, and it really maintains a good... you get good air drainage, so there isn't a lot of freezing that happens, and you wind up having a very stable climate in that end of the valley. If you go further out into the valley, 30 miles to the west, you don't get that air drainage, and you lose the availability of planting a lot of fruit crops. And if you try going further east up into the Debec Canyon, you don't get enough sunlight. So we're really situated in a very... very important location, and it's exceptional for growing grapes as well as for growing peaches. There is a very large, and from the 1930s all the way through the present day, there have been millions of pounds of peaches grown in western Colorado, and they're shipped all over the world. And so it's really the peach and grape capital of Colorado, and we put out more fruit out of that valley than you can possibly imagine.
I'm sure of that, because I am surprised even now. When do you get the bud break? What time in the spring?
That's the fun part. Everyone else goes through bud break, and they've already finished their pruning. We have not even pruned yet. And it would actually be dangerous to be pruning now. Although it was 65 degrees, we actually have seen snow in the month of May.
Oh,
so,
wow.
We have to be very cautious with when we are going to be pruning, because after you prune, grapes start to freak out a little bit, and they start to push nutrients to those buds, and you can actually force bud break by pruning too early. Years ago, when we first put our vineyards in, the common school of thought was, you know, you prune in January and February, and you have bud break in April. And
right.
then in May, it snowed, and we lost 95% of the crop. And we said, you know, we might want to reconsider what we're doing here. And so, you know, if you're a transplanted winemaker, or you try to do what you've always done and it's always worked in every other place that I've ever made wine, Colorado's not probably the best location, because you really have to relearn everything that you're doing. So we will prune in mid-March through early April, and then we pray for bud break to not happen until the end of April, because honestly, the ski resorts will stay open this year until June. And they're less than 100 miles from where we are. So,
wow.
You know, there is still the threat of winter well into May.
Hopefully
that answers your question. When do we have bud break? As late as physically possible, please.
Yeah. Well, then, okay, so you have bud break, but, you know, I noticed the list of the wines that you grow, or the grapes that you grow, you're going to need so many days for those things to get mature. So when are you harvesting?
Correct. So, once again, the issue comes if you're a transplanted winemaker, if you're trying to use the same calendar that you've used while you work in Napa, it will not work in Colorado. Harvest usually doesn't happen until mid-September, and it will go into October. We will get it done as quickly as possible because, once again, we can almost count on there being snow by October 31st.
Hmm.
So, you know, we push it as fast as we possibly can, as long as we possibly can. I mean, we're still getting a good growing season of 182 days. So, you know, we look for harvest around mid-September. This last year, we had a particularly hot year, and we were harvesting 1st of September. Some people have even harvested as early as mid-August.
Wow.
But once again, in Napa last year, the first grapes were coming off in July. So, you know, we were ahead of schedule as the rest of the changing climate areas in the world were. And we were a little bit ahead of schedule. So, you know, we're taking a look at that, and we're choosing when we're going to prune based on what we expect this upcoming year to be. So we're going to wait till mid-March to prune, and then pray for bud break in September, in April, and then harvest in September.
Mm. You mentioned snow a couple of times there. With only 19 inches a year of precipitation, I would think that the snow would not be that much.
Snow is not generally that much. Now, 19 inches, remember, that's inches of water, not inches of snow. An inch of snow will produce like a quarter of an inch or a fifth of an inch of water. So, you know, right now our vineyards are very, very wet. We had a very good snowstorm. We received approximately 18 inches of snow over from about the 1st of February to the 8th of February. And that was enough to put a halt on traffic and everything else. it also works very well to keep the vines insulated during the cold season. So, you know, the more snow and the more dirt and the more water you have, the harder it is going to be to freeze the roots, to freeze the vines and the shoots and everything else. So we rely on snow very heavily. But once again, we're not generally receiving massive amounts of snow. This was a storm for the record books a couple weeks ago. That usually doesn't happen. In a given season, we can expect between 24 and 36 inches of total snowfall from November through March, and then they stop keeping track, and then we get more snow in May. So who knows? Who knows?
Well, that's really not that much, though. I mean, when you start looking at some other areas and what, you know, they average and all that, so...
Right, exactly.
You know.
It really isn't. You know, everybody expects Colorado to be, oh, it's skiing, and oh, it's this, and oh, it's that, and really it's very agricultural on that side of the hill, and we don't receive as much snow as everyone expects us to.
Hmm. Yeah, well, and another thing, too, I'm sure that the location between, well, before the Rockies there, it's not dumping so much on you as it does after the Rockies, when it basically rips open the clouds and lets all the snow fall on the eastern side. So,
correct. Yeah. And yes, we'll leave it at that. Yes, you are correct.
Yeah. So we have established the weather. What grows there? What do you plant? What do you harvest? What is your crops?
You know, everybody has a different opinion on what they think grows the best and what they think is the – everyone is always searching for what is the Colorado varietal. You know, is it – Napa is famous for their Cabernets, and Sancerre is famous for its Sauvignon Blanc, and Bordeaux is famous for its Bordeaux blend. We really – when we plant And when we specifically planted our vines, we looked at three different factors. We looked at the length of the growing season, which includes daylight intensity hours. We looked at the soil profile, and then we looked at the weather and anticipated snowfall and cold hardiness. In certain areas of Colorado, you must plant vines that are very cold hardy, which means that they won't freeze over the winter. That being said, the majority of grapevines that are planted around the world are done in what is called a grafted rootstock style.
Right.
In the, you know, when phylloxera took over France in the 1860s through the early 1900s, and it was found that U.S. rootstock was not susceptible to the phylloxera plague that occurred, all of France started grafting onto U.S. rootstock. In Colorado, if you plant on grafted rootstock, the graft becomes a very dangerous place on the vine, and the graft will actually freeze. And so you won't actually get a good seal between the two, and so you'll have really good roots, and then you'll have nothing growing on top. And because we have, knock on wood, because we have not yet seen phylloxera, nor do we ever expect phylloxera in Colorado, we are currently using own-rooted grapevines.
Wow.
So when we plant Chardonnay, we are planting Chardonnay vines from the root all the way up. And every nursery that we talk to tells us, oh, you couldn't possibly do that. What happens when you run into a problem? And, you know, what about soil moisture? Well, that's, you know, we're in Colorado. We have very good drainage, and we have very cold winters in comparison to Napa or Bordeaux or anywhere else. And so we don't wind up having that that high humidity problem, and we don't wind up having any mildew issues. And so we can utilize rootstocks that are own-rooted grapevines. So what grows well in our area? We specifically have planted Merlot and have been extremely successful with the growth of Merlot. Chardonnay is one of the key whites that is planted in our vineyard specifically. The last couple of years, Chardonnay is not a particularly cold hardy grape varietal, and so the last couple of years when we had a December where the temperature never got above 15 degrees Fahrenheit, we lost our Chardonnay vines and they went all the way to the ground. So
wow.
we are in a rebuilding year as far as Chardonnay goes. It's coming back. This is our second year of growth, so we'll have a small crop this year. Probably not more than about 2 tons per acre, whereas pre-freeze we were putting out between 5 and 6 tons per acre.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So Chardonnay and Merlot do very well as far as Bordeaux and Burgundy varietals. And then we have actually planted Barbera, which is a northern Italian grape varietal that grows well in well-drained soil, and it requires a very high level of sunlight in order for the skins to ripen completely. And in western Colorado, it is a rare day that it rains in the summertime, and we get very, very high UV in our area. There's very little moisture in the air that is absorbing that ultraviolet radiation. So high UV and high sunlight lends itself to thicker-skinned grapes such as Barbera. We don't quite receive enough sunlight or enough daylight intensity hours to grow something like Zinfandel, but we are currently experimenting with Primitivo, which is a very, 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 very close relative. A few minor differences, but a very close relative. We also grow Nebbiolo, which is typically a grape that requires a lot of humidity. Its name comes from the Italian word for clouds or fog. And so we're trying to grow that in an area that receives a lot of sunlight and see if we can get a different style of Nebbiolo than the typical Barolo style that most people are used to. And as far as whites go, we're doing, like I said, Chardonnay. And then we do a Viognier called Mountain Dew. Montagne Dew is actually what we call it, the French for mountain soft or mountain sweet. It's a very nice, light, easy-drinking Viognier with a very different backbone than what most people are expecting from a typical Rhone varietal Viognier that's light and clear and green and grassy. Ours is more full-bodied and has more honeydew and peach flavors that come out of it than anything else. And for the final varietals that we do, we grow orange Moscato and black Moscato, and we make those into sparkling wines and more of an aperitif wine at our facility as well.
Oh, because I was looking at your list, your website, and I noticed the orange and black Moscatos, and so those are sparkling wines on both of those. Okay.
On one of those, the black Moscato, we finished as a Moscato d'Asti, and we finished it's finished dry, so it's a brut style as opposed to the light, sweet, and sweet, again.
Sweet.
Moscato's
sweet.
Right. And, you know, most people expect Moscato's to be sweet, and ours is produced in a different style so that it's more clean and fresh. It tastes like ripe strawberries with vanilla cream and a little bit of fizz, but there is no sweetness to it. So it isn't like drinking a mouthful of syrup, which is a nice change from... Go ahead.
What's your residual sugar on your Moscato's then?
That would be zero. It is finished completely dry, and the secondary fermentation takes complete care of any residual sugar that would be added to it. As far as a post bottle secondary addition, there is not one, so we're not adding any sweetness back to it when we put it into the bottle. So it is finished in a very traditional brut style.
Wow, that now when people come into the winery and they say, "Well, I love a Moscato," I can say, "Do you know that there are ones that are made with no sugars in it?"
That's right, exactly. Well, and you know, all of our tasting at our winery, we request that everyone that comes in, we do a blind tasting with them, because you know everybody has a preconception of what they expect a wine to taste like, and
right.
I can't tell you how much I've heard someone say, "Oh, well, you know, I don't drink Chardonnay and I don't drink Merlot," and I'll say, "Okay, well, I have something for you to try." And we pour it for them blind, and it kind of takes them back, because, you know, if all you were used to drinking for Merlot was a typical $5 bottle of Merlot from Napa, which there's nothing wrong with that, but it's a different style than a 25-year-old Chateau Petrus.
Yeah.
And yet both of those are 100% Merlot. And so, you know, we look at that and we say, look, open up your mind as to what a wine can be, not what you think it is. And we enjoy spending some time with all of the clientele that come through. We do a wine education seminar with every single guest, and we teach how to introduce wine into your palate, how to make the flavors come alive on your palate. You know, you go to wine tastings all the time, and you hear, "Oh, well, I taste this or I smell that," and you're thinking there's no possible way that you taste that or smell that. But there is really it's not really a trick to it, but there's a level of education that comes with it. And it comes from what was learned at Davis about the palate and about the introduction of beverages across the palate. And we like to teach why you, as the general population, enjoys what you enjoy. Are you a Coke drinker or a Pepsi drinker? Do you drink your coffee black or with cream and sugar? Are you a vodka drinker or a whiskey drinker? Do you drink dark beers with a lot of hops in them, or do you like something a little bit lighter, a Pilsner or something like that? And it really comes down to how you're introducing those beverages across your palate, and we like to change it up and have you introduce it a couple of different ways, and that's something that you'll have to come to the winery to experience. I could talk about it and on the radio and no one would understand, but if you come to the winery, we like to teach that and provide that as an experience to every guest that comes through.
That sounds fascinating on that. You and I were talking about that a little bit a couple of days ago when we first talked, and that sounds like a great way to get people to understand what it is they're drinking. I have people all the time come into the winery down here, and they go, they read a description. They say, "Well, I can't taste any of that stuff." And I said, "Yes, you can." I said, "Now, it's not going to jump out at you. It's not going to be like you're eating a bell pepper. But you can detect some of the characteristics, and that's what you're looking for." And so,
right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a very easy way, and we can talk about this at length if you're interested. There's an easy way to read a label and determine what your wine is going to taste like without ever even removing the cork. And you can, you know, we all have the things that we enjoy the most. You know, I really like... for example, I like a good Pinot Noir, and I like it at a certain style. I like it to be a little bit more ripe, a little bit more full flavored, as opposed to underripe pie cherry flavor. And there's an easy way to look at a label and determine, you know, what am I getting? Is it just something that I need to roll the dice and hope that I get the right thing, or is there a way to gain some knowledge behind this and really have the opportunity to try a lot of different things and really develop my own palate as a wine connoisseur or as an avid wine buyer?
That is a good point. People come in all the time, and maybe you can help on this. I am not aware of, but I make an un-oaked Chardonnay. And people say, well, I don't like Chardonnays. And I say, well, you're probably used to the oaky ones, and maybe the oaky are not really caring for. Try the un-oaked. And they say, well, this is good. This is different. It's not that, oakiness. And they said, can you go into a store and tell if it's oaked or un-oaked? And my response usually is, not really. If you look at the label, they like to brag about it being oaked, and so they'll say oaked. But otherwise, if they don't, then you won't know. I may be wrong on that. Maybe you can set me straight on this a little bit here.
Well, we can go into this, and without going into too much detail, we can easily outline a few key factors. You know, everyone has this expectation that wine is a beverage. You know, we all think, we look at a wine list, and we all expect wine as a beverage, and we're used to thinking of it as a beverage. And in reality, wine is fruit. And if we stop thinking of wine as a beverage and begin to think about wine as fruit and the flavors that are brought along with that fruit, we can develop a better idea about why wine tastes the way that it does. So, for example, you know, in the very early stages, as the grapes are developing, the buds have already set, we're in mid-June or early July, and we hit a point in time that we're ready to start deciding what we want to do in this upcoming year to make wine. Well, all fruit ripens the exact same way. When fruit is underripe, it has a very high level of acid and a very low level of sugar. And it doesn't matter if it's a banana, an apple, a cantaloupe, or a grape. They all have the same thing. We'll pick on bananas because that's a fairly easy thing to look at. So we all know what a green banana tastes like, right? It's right. Kind of grassy. It's kind of it's not sweet. It's kind of pulpy, and it's acidic. Well, as the fruit ripens, the acid level starts to drop off, and the sugar level starts to increase. And the point at which those two lines cross when we're growing wine grapes is called veraison, hence the name of our winery, veraison. If you speak French, it is veraison. But if we're American, it's pronounced veraison, hence veraison vineyards and winery. And approximately 30 to 45 days after veraison, depending on a litany of different factors that fall in there, but approximately 35 to 45 days after veraison is when we're going to harvest. So at veraison, the sugar and acid levels are at equilibria, and that means that they are approximately equal. And we can talk about as much chemistry as you want in the future, but we'll just assume that that's the point at which they're equal. We don't harvest at veraison because there's still a very high level of acid and a very low level of sugar. And that would yield a very acidic wine, which would be almost undrinkable. Now, as the fruit ripens, the sugar level goes as high as it could possibly go, and the acid level drops off to nothing. Yet we don't ever eat black bananas. You know, they have their place, and they're great for making banana bread, but just by themselves, you know, a black or overripe banana really has a different flavor to it than what most people expect a banana to taste like.
Right.
We usually, when we're eating bananas, I like mine a little bit green. You know, if the top of the stem is a little green and the skin is mostly yellow, that's perfect for me. But some people like them yellow with little brown dots. And wherever you like them, there's no wrong place to enjoy your banana at that ripeness. You just know by looking at it that the banana is going to have that flavor to it. Grapes do the exact same thing. Grapes start out producing a very high level of acid and a very low level of sugar. When we harvest them, however soon we harvest them determines what the wine is going to taste like after we make it. So if we harvest our grapes and they have a very high level of acid and a very low level of sugar, that means that you're going to have a more tart or more acidic wine. If you allow the grapes to ripen a little bit more, and unlike bananas that will ripen on your countertop, grapes will not continue to ripen. You get more oxidation, but you don't get more sugar development. You get a different physiological pathway than traditional ripening for grapes. So you can't pick them and then hold on to them for a month and expect them to ripen like you would a banana. it doesn't work that way. Sadly, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. So we harvest them, and then we make them into wine as soon as physically possible, because we don't want any degradation to occur with those grapes. So in the vineyard, acid is converted into sugar. And then in the winery, sugar is converted into alcohol. And it's a 1-to-1-to-1 conversion, with a little conversion factor figured in there. But realistically, it's 1-to-1-to-1. So if you know the amount of any one, if you know two of those three numbers, you automatically know what the other one is. Or if you know one of those, you can make a fairly decent guess at what the other two would be or would have been when you were growing your grapes. So if you like your wine, let's pick a white. Let's do Sauvignon Blanc, okay? Or even easier, let's do Chardonnay. That one's really simple. Most people have had a Chardonnay. So Chardonnay, if you pick your Chardonnay grapes too early and they're brought into the winery and they have too much acid and not enough sugar, low sugar will yield low alcohol. So high acid, low sugar, low alcohol. And the bottom rung in the ladder for Chardonnay typically is 12% alcohol by volume. And all Chardonnays, keep in mind we're painting with a broad brush here, Chardonnay that is harvested so that it will produce 12% alcohol by volume, if it's done naturally, will produce the flavor of green Granny Smith apple in your finished Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
So if you enjoy that green Granny Smith apple in your Chardonnay, find one that says 12% alcohol by volume on the front or the back of the label, and that's what you'll expect every single time. Now, if you allow the grapes to ripen just a little bit more, let's say that you increase it by 1% sugar, and you bump up your 2% sugar, which will yield 1% alcohol. Let's say that you now have a Chardonnay at 13% alcohol by volume. You don't ever lose the apple flavor, but the apple is no longer the green Granny Smith Malic apple flavor. It becomes more yellow apple, more golden delicious flavor. And there's a pronounced difference between a green apple and a yellow apple, much as there is the same difference between a Chardonnay at 12% and a Chardonnay at 13%. Additionally, at 13%, Chardonnay will produce a pear flavor. You'll get more of a ripe Bartlett pear flavor that will come out of that. Not the overripe, like black pear flavor, but the really good ripe Bartlett pear in the middle of the summer. At 14% alcohol by volume, going up one click once again, the fruit continues to ripen. You get yellow apple, ripe Bartlett pear, and you'll start to gain more of a melon note, either cantaloupe or honeydew. Really ripe honeydew, though, not the kind off the salad bar in January, because there's, once again, a distinct difference between ripe melon and underripe melon. So if you pick the flavor that you enjoy in your wine, you can look at a label and determine what your flavors are going to be. And the range for white wine is generally between 12% and 14%, assuming that they didn't ever add sugar to it, which in the United States is frowned upon. But it is done extensively in France and elsewhere around the world. So if you know the condition of your fruit when you harvested it, and you know that you have approximately 23 degrees Brix when you harvested, that means that you're going to have a Chardonnay that's going to produce about 13.5% alcohol by volume, if I'm doing my mental calculation properly. So if you find a Chardonnay that you enjoy, check the alcohol concentration. And the next time that you're out at a restaurant and you want a similar bottle of wine, ask to see the bottle prior to opening it. And if it comes out and it shows 12% on the label and you know that you don't like the flavor of green Granny Smith apples in your wine, don't order that bottle of wine. Check the label before you open the bottle, and it will tell you everything that you need to know about that distinct bottle of wine. Chardonnay, however, your specific question was about oaked versus unoaked. And when we are talking about oaking a Chardonnay, we use oak for two different reasons. The first reason is because it has been done for the last 2,000 years, and we are stuck with using oak barrels. But beyond using oak barrels for a storage vessel, which they're not particularly convenient, as a winemaker, I will tell you right now that they are more of a pain to use than they are, they're glamorous. Let's put it that way. They look really pretty, and they do a couple things, but, you know, what's the other reason that we use oak barrels? It sits around, and over time, it develops flavor from that oak barrel. You know, we talk about the oaky flavor in our Chardonnay. We don't talk about, oh, it looks pretty in an oak barrel. We don't care about that. We're interested in the flavor. Now, flavor development in white wine, and the reason why you don't see a majority of white wines put into oak barrels is because it requires an elevated amount of alcohol to extract the flavor properly out of an oak barrel. If you're doing your extraction and you put a Chardonnay that is at 12% alcohol by volume into an oak barrel, your extraction rate will be either so slow that you don't have time to wait for it, or so inefficient that the amount of money that you're spending on that oak barrel will never be able to be reinterpreted to the consumer, and you'll never be able to pass that along as an oaky buttery Chardonnay. Oaky buttery Chardonnays, which became very popular in Napa from the mid-1990s through the present day, there are still some exceptional ones that are made, are generally no less than 13.5% alcohol by volume. And realistically, if you go any lower than that, your rate of extraction decreases from your oak barrel faster than you can possibly imagine. So it's important when you're making wine that you make those decisions in the very, very beginning and say, do I want to make a light, crisp, refreshing Chardonnay that is stainless steel fermented that tastes like apples and pears? Or do I want to make a Chardonnay that tastes like butterscotch and caramel, ripe Hawaiian pineapple, really ripe melon, very smooth, very creamy, with a buttery finish? We produce both at our winery. We make a Chardonnay that we call Cuvée Blanc, which is it's a clean, crisp, refreshing Chardonnay. It did see a certain amount of oak because it is still at 13.5%, but it's not the smoothest, and it's not designed to be a heavy oak Chardonnay. It's not set out to be that way. If you enjoy that style of wine, we produce a wine at our winery called Crème Brûlée, and if you enjoy the dessert, you'll absolutely adore the wine. Crème Brûlée is a Chardonnay. It's finished at 14.5% alcohol by volume.
Wow.
And it tastes like butterscotch and vanilla, caramel and ripe Hawaiian pineapple, yet it is not overly alcoholic on the palate, nor is there any sweetness to it whatsoever. So it has the aroma of butterscotch, but without the syrupy, mouth-coating sensation that you get when you put a Werther's candy into your palate. So, you know, you can go either way, and you can decide the style that you like, and you can look at the alcohol concentration and determine whether or not that wine is likely to exist within that style. It's not an exact science, but it is sure a whole heck of a lot closer than you would be before just taking a wild guess at it.
And wild guesses a lot of times are wrong. Very good. That's very interesting, Alex. I enjoyed that. So you mentioned those two wines, and we talked a little bit about your Moscatos and the Merlots, but, you know, I am a great big Barbera fan. I just absolutely love Barbera. Tell me about your Barbera.
Well, Barbera in the United States is generally, we see it as an import more often than not, and it comes from one of two areas. It's either Barbera di Alba or Barbera di Asti, and those are typically, they're Italian-style wines, and they're made for a local market, and then we happen to import some to the United States. Barbera is a grape that produces a very nice, ripe pie cherry flavor, so it's a little bit more tart than you would get out of a fully ripe Merlot. Merlot is more of a black cherry and black currant flavor. Barbera is more ripe pie cherry. And the one that we produce, I currently have two vintages available. The one that we produce is you get ripe pie cherry, cedar, and spice, like cardamom and nutmeg, as the flavor comes across your palate. And it's it finishes, it's a very bright finish across the palate, but not drying. The challenge with Barbera is if you allow the grapes to ripen too much, you wind up producing too high of an alcohol concentration, and you wind up getting kind of either a burned or a raisin flavor that will come out of your wines. And so they're generally picked a little bit earlier. We are unique in Western Colorado in that we can choose when we pick because the fruit is going to have good skin ripeness very early on. We have nice hot days and nice bright intense sun, which allows the skin tannins and the phenolics and the cyanins to ripen very quickly. And so we get a very well-developed palate and flavor, but without any of that oxidized characteristic that you'll get. And we've produced two different versions of our Barbera. Both are available currently. One is a filtered version that we've actually run through cross-flow filtration. Makes it very bright and very, very clear all the way through. But typically, Italian Barberas, especially if you're drinking them outside of the United States, are done unfiltered, where they are simply allowed to cold stabilize and settle to the bottom of the tank, and then they are bottled without filtration. And so they leave a little bit of a haziness through them. It's the same as if you drink Coors Light beer versus a wheat beer or a Hefeweizen. You know, neither one is bad, but they're different than the other one. And you could theoretically make a Coors Light or a Pilsner in an unfiltered style, but it would be different than if you filtered it. So the filtered wine generally has more of a fruit-forward characteristic to it, whereas the unfiltered wine has more of a dark chocolate note on the very beginning and then finishes with cedar and spice all the way through.
Sounds fascinating. I I really do love a Barbera, and that sounds fascinating. You mentioned oak a couple of times, and do you use oak barrels? Do you use oak slats, logs?
Right, exactly. So you ask yourself the question, you know, if all you're interested in is the flavor, what's the difference between adding the wine to the barrel or adding the barrel to the wine?
None.
You know, what would happen if you chopped the oak barrel up into a bunch of little blocks, put it into a tea bag, and then dropped it down inside of a stainless steel tank that had your wine in it? Mm-hmm. Everything else being equal, we're talking temperature, pressure, evaporation rate, alcohol concentration, air oxidation, the oxidation reduction potential. I mean, every chemical panel and profile that you can possibly imagine, if everything else is equal, shouldn't you be able to get the same flavor out of your using an oak tea bag versus using an oak barrel? And in California, this is done all the time. There are a lot of wineries that are moving away from the oak barrel market, and they are moving into what is called an oak alternative or a barrel alternative. We use slats of oak that are actually barrels that were being made at the facility at the barrel cooper that would not hold liquid, and they're leftover slats, and they're cooked exactly the same. It's the exact same thing that you would get in your barrel, except it comes in a little piece, and you calculate the surface area of the inside of a barrel, figure out what the surface area of the inside of one of these tea bags is going to be, utilizing all of the little pieces that are in there, calculate the amount of liquid on the inside of your tank, and then add the corresponding number of tea bags to your tank to extract your flavor. And we're a little bit different in that we don't just taste our wine to determine whether or not the oak extraction is done. We look at the chemical profile and the chemical panel of that wine and make a better than educated guess as to how much oak has been extracted and how much of those oak lactones are being pulled into the wine naturally through that extraction process.
And if you're not careful, then you can over-oak very easily doing it that way, too, I tell you.
Right. Yeah, it's like making coffee. You know, how long do you, or making tea, how long do you leave the tea bag in? Or how long do you boil the coffee beans in the water for? You know, you can very easily over-extract it and wind up with something that's undrinkable.
I've talked to wineries before and during the years on the program, and they have mentioned, oh, my gosh, I didn't realize, you know, how much stronger the oak can come out when you start doing the teabag method. So,
right, exactly. And it's a much faster extraction rate. Because in an oak barrel, the wine is never seeing the end of the wood that has all the xylem in it that allows the water to move through the oak tree up and through it. It never sees the ends of the oak staves. It only ever sees the sides of the oak staves.
Right.
And if you allow capillary action to work through the oak the longitudinal way, it will extract significantly faster than you would ever expect it to. And so, you know, it really, if you are going to use the oak teabag or oak stave or any other barrel alternative method, you have to be very on top of your chemistry panel and very on top of what is going on, because like you said, it will over-extract and do it in a hurry. And then then you're stuck. There isn't a whole lot that you can do to repair that. There are some things, but not a whole lot that the small winery can do to repair an over-oaked wine.
Yeah, and it's, you know, over the years, I've had people tell me, oh my gosh, I didn't know they were blending and doing all sorts of stuff, trying to un-oak their over-oak. So it's very easy to do. Wineries in Colorado, you mentioned 114 of them or something like that up to now.
106. Yeah, 106 currently.
How difficult has the state of Colorado been in your support or getting you all to get your license and everything? Is Colorado friendly to wineries, or do you have to battle them? What's the word on that?
Well, it kind of depends. Colorado, for those that aren't aware, Colorado has some fairly liberal policies when it comes to the consumption of materials. And that's the nice way of putting it. The liquor laws in Colorado, you know, Colorado was actually one of the very first states to enact prohibition. And one of the last holdouts to allow people to have alcohol again.
Wow.
There were actually grapes that were being grown in Colorado as early as the early 1900s. And naturally, you know, what do you do with grapes? You can't eat 60 acres worth of grapes. You need to do something with them. So there are not currently any listed wineries from the day, but we know that wine growing and wine making has been part of Colorado history since the early 1900s. In the 1960s and 70s was really the resurgence of wineries in Colorado, and particularly on the western slope where we're located in Palisade. And there were wineries that started to spring up, and through the 90s the numbers started to grow. And from 2000 until 2015, it went from less than 30 wineries to over 100, and it did it very quickly. So if I can't speak to the current difficulty to receive a license in Colorado, but I can tell you that if anything is being said for alcohol production in Colorado and other production in Colorado, we are always open to new business. We have more microbreweries currently in Colorado than any other state in the union per capita. We're really very on top of the microbrewery and winery development. Go hand in hand, and so we're working intra-industry to develop a lot of very, very exciting new products and to really capitalize on the availability of scientific knowledge here in the state. So in answer to your question, I would feel that it would be fairly easy to become part of the Colorado wine industry, but forget everything that you learned about being in wine industries anywhere else in the world, because it's a lot of it would not apply.
Yeah,
it
certainly
sounds
like
grapes in Colorado for sure.
Yeah, as is the problem in most states, does Colorado have a problem of getting enough state-grown grapes to keep up with the demand?
The demand in Colorado is very unique. We are, and I'll speak specifically for ourselves and less for other people. There are currently more than 1,000 planted acres in Colorado of wine grapes, and we're getting between 2.5 and 5 tons per acre. So there's a fairly substantial amount of grapes that are currently being grown in the state of Colorado. In 2008 and 2009, we had a very late frost in the spring, and everyone that thought that it was a good idea to prune in February found out that it was probably not a good idea to prune in February. And so we had a very significant crop loss in 2008, 2009 that we are still recovering from.
Wow.
For example, our winery, we did not make wine in 2008 or 2009. It was that bad. And we have quite a few acres that we are currently utilizing. So the need for more wine grapes in Colorado is definitely there. We can use everything that we can grow and then some. We just purchased 6 additional new 3 fermentation tanks and 3 bright tanks for doing additional operations at our winery. I am completely at capacity. 2015 was a bumper crop year. We are at 130% of capacity in our vineyard, and we were actually selling grapes for pennies on the dollar.
Wow.
So that being said, this was a really good year. Knock on wood, this was a very, very good year. And I would like to see that continue into the future, but I have no control over the weather. So, you know, we're still farmers. We still have to deal with weather issues. But I do feel that we need as many wine grapes as can be planted and as many consistent production wine grapes as can be planted. There's been a lot of feel about planting different hybrid grape varietals and varietals that have not really been heard of. And the problem with planting varietals that have not been heard of is that if you've never heard of them, they're very difficult to sell.
Right.
People are, the population is familiar with what a Riesling is or what a Chardonnay is, and maybe less familiar with what a Dornfelder is or some of the more obscure varietals. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with those at all, but the production side, from the winemaking side of things, I want to make a product that sells and make a consistent quality product that sells. So,
and if people know the name of it, it is much easier to sell it than ones that they don't know the name of it. What you end up doing is you say, this tastes just like a Sauvignon Blanc, or this tastes just, you know, and you hate doing that, but that's how you have to approach it.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's been a push as of late to plant different hybrid varietals. You know, it's kind of the knee-jerk reaction after 2008, 2009 of winemakers saying, oh, I can't, that could never happen to me again. I need to put in something that is foolproof. Well, you know, from the early 90s through last year, Chardonnay was foolproof. Merlot was foolproof. Cabernet Franc was foolproof. But, you know, you have 2 bad years in a row, and then people start to reassess what they're planting and what they're making. And for good reason. I completely understand that. But from a marketing side of things, we also have to understand that there are certain limitations that we have as winemakers as well.
You mentioned Cabernet Franc. You don't do a Cabernet Franc or a Cabernet Sauvignon?
I do not do either of those currently. But there is a large push in the state of Colorado for Cabernet Franc, and we are known in national competitions for the quality of the Cabernet Franc that is made at a lot of the area wineries around where our winery is located. And it's done very well. Cabernet Sauvignon we tend to stay away from because that's everyone expects it to be Napa Valley Cabernet Sauvignon, and it will never be. You know, there's nothing wrong with the way that we make it, but the expectation is there, and you know, trying to get away from the expectation is really the hard part, and hence why we do blind tastings at our winery, is to say, hey, look, you know, do you like this or not? What is it about it that you like? And how could you have this, not only from us, but how could you find a similar bottle like this anywhere in the world? And it's fairly easy to do. So Cabernet Franc, there's been a very large push for that, and it's actually very well done. I have quite a few winemaker friends that have done absolutely exceptional ones that I would not hesitate to take to either national or international competitions, and I feel that they would fare very well.
As much as I like Barbera, the Cabernet Franc is right up there with it. Those are my two absolute favorite red grapes, I think, the Barbera and Cabernet Franc. There's just some wonderful ones out there. So I just wonder if you were venturing into that or not. Mike, do you have any questions here for Alex?
Well, we were talking about the government briefly there. Do you have any issues with your shipping out of state? Is it? Do you have any government regulations against that or no?
Colorado is set up more or less as a three-tier system, but the nice thing about having a winery license, a limited winery license in Colorado, allows direct-to-consumer sales and direct-to-consumer shipping for a majority of state locations. We are required to purchase a state license for certain individual states across the United States for selling wine direct-to-consumer to those states, and we have a list of that available at our tasting room. And it changes annually. So it changes annually. I thought I had the most recent one, and it just continues to change. But we are allowed to sell direct to consumer, and we do sell internationally as well, directly out of our tasting room. We are currently 100% direct to consumer, which means that we have no liquor store sales or availability coming from our tasting room. And, you know, we're doing upwards of 200,000 bottles a year is what we're going to be at this upcoming year. So, you know, we're a fairly large winery as far as Colorado is concerned, but small wineries in Napa spill more wine in a year than we make in a year. So, you know, it's all kind of you kind of put it out there and say, you know, how big is big? So we do ship direct to consumer, and the products can be purchased directly by calling our tasting room in Palisade at 970-464-4928, and mention that you heard it on this show, and we'll do something special. We have to talk about what we're going to do, but we're going to do something special for callers from this show. So,
cool. Mike,
yeah, exactly.
You and I are going to have to call.
Yeah, exactly. Right. We'll put you on the list. How about that?
There you go. Also, Mike and I were talking before this show. Or at the beginning, I can't remember, if you are in a wine trail because of all the different wineries around your area.
There is. It is just initiated in our area. It is not a it's a Colorado wine trail, and I can't remember. If you hadn't asked me, I could have just told you. There is a trail that takes you around the Grand Valley AVA, the American Viticulture Appellation, and it's approximately a 17-mile loop, and you can actually ride a bicycle around the whole thing and visit, I think it's 24 wineries within that loop. It's very well outlined, and it's been very well put together, and during the summer, you know, a bike ride is really a very pleasant thing to do. I probably wouldn't do it in the middle of July, but anytime, you know, if you started in the morning and then we're at a winery from noon until 3, and then you left at 3 to return back, you'd be fine. It wouldn't be that big of a deal. You know, it's summertime. We have to expect it to be a little on the warm side, but it's a dry heat, so it's okay.
Yeah, dry heat.
Right. But like I said, there are a lot of really good wineries along that trail, and, you know, wine tasting is really it's a treasure hunt. It's deciding what it is that you like, determining why you like it, and then purchasing the bottles that you do enjoy, and then sharing that experience with friends. You know, we don't ever generally remember exactly the bottle of wine that we drank, but we remember the experiences that we had while we drank it, and the people with whom we were. You know, we want to share those experiences, and so, you know, it's a quick, easy trip from Denver. It's a 3.5-hour car trip over two beautiful mountain passes. You go right through the town of Vail, you go past Breckenridge and through Glenwood, and then it's 253 miles from Denver to Palisade, and there's a lot of accommodations. There's a brand new hotel that just went in right in the middle of Palisade, and there's some really good restaurants that are going in and are in downtown Palisade, so we're really excited about that.
From Salt Lake City, how far?
Salt Lake City is approximately 300 miles, and it kind of depends on what's easier. Salt Lake City, you go over Soldier Summit and drop down through Green River and then jump on I-70, and from Green River to Palisade is 90 miles, I believe.
Oh.
And so it's really very beautiful either way you go. There's more to see in Colorado than there is probably in that section from Utah, but it's still, I do it every couple weeks, and it's absolutely beautiful. So, and Moab is an hour and a half away from Palisades, so there's a lot to do in Grand Junction and in the Grand Valley area as well. We have less than an hour away is Aspen Ski Area. The Grand Mesa National Forest is a 30-minute drive away, and it's a high mountain plateau that takes you over 10,000 feet of elevation, and there's a ski area called Powderhorn up there as well, and some of the best fishing in the world. Fly fishing and freshwater trout fishing is to be had up on the Grand Mesa. And that's an easy afternoon trip or before you go wine tasting. I'd recommend doing that and then come wine tasting and have some fun.
You mentioned a bike ride on the trail. Does Grand Rapids or Palisades have bike rentals available?
There is a really good bike shop in downtown Palisades called Rapid Creek Cycles, and they do rent bicycles for the use on the wine tours. Basically, they just got recently 150 brand new cruiser bikes with baskets on them, and they're purple and really pretty and really a lot of fun. And you know, all of the wineries, we all have bike racks, and we all expect that in the summertime for guests to come in and leave their bikes out, parked outside, and then get some wine. And there's a lot of fun places to sit and enjoy a snack on the route. There's a couple of really nice restaurants and a brand new French bistro that is going into the middle of downtown Palisades that will be opening up around the 1st of June. So a lot of fun things to do in Palisades and a lot of availability once you get to Grand Junction.
You paint a beautiful picture. Mike, any last questions or anything for Alex?
No, it's just, really tested my typing skill today. It's a lot of, I don't know how
good.
Many pages I got on here. Amazing. I was just thinking, though, if you're on a bike doing 17 miles, and I guess if you go at a good pace, I don't know if you get to, you know, experience all 24 wineries, but that sounds nice.
Typically, it's a full weekend, and this is just the Palisade area. If you come over on a Friday evening, and you get to Palisade, and you start at most wineries open at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the majority are open until 5. We are open until 6 on weekends. And, you know, it's a nice, easy ride. There is one small uphill that you'll have to do, and then the rest of it is downhill the whole way, and it's a nice, easy trip, and you can really have some fun with it after renting your bike. So, you know, if you're not wanting to do the whole 17 miles, there are more than a handful, close to 10 wineries right around the downtown area, as we are located within the downtown area of Palisade, and they are all very easily accessible. And all of those roads are completely flat, which is really nice because, you know, if you come up from – you don't realize it, but if you come up from sea level and you're now – we're almost a mile high, there's significantly less oxygen up there than what you would expect. So – you know, you'll start to feel it pretty quickly. So, you know, it's a nice easy cruise and nice flat roads and beautiful scenery to take in the entire time. Painted against the rising plateau of the what are called the book lists. They look like a bunch of books set on a shelf, and that's one edge of the valley. And then the Grand Mesa Plateau rises to over 10,000 feet. Right, immediately starts at the edge of Palisade and goes directly up from there. And if you're more adventuresome, there's just exceptional mountain biking, hiking, backpacking, camping, and four wheeling up on the Grand Mesa as well.
Wow.
So you know it's really a great weekend trip. There are a lot of people from Denver and really from all over the world that you know you fly into Denver and then you rent a car in Denver. You drive 3.5 hours. And it's 3.5 hours away, and not a second more to paradise, which is absolutely perfect.
I've been across I-70, I think it is, and saw Grand Mesa and all that. That whole area is just it's beautiful. It's very scenic, just amazing. It's been many years before I've gone across there, but yeah, I've been across. I think it's 70 that runs through there.
Yes, it is. Yep, Interstate 70.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, many years for me, too, but I've been on I-70, and it's just, it's gorgeous, just absolutely beautiful area.
Right. Yeah, it's a blessing and a privilege to live here, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and you can tell that you're excited about it just how you talk about it. Give us all the information about Verizon Vineyard and Winery, Facebook, tweet, everything.
Of course. We are Verizon Vineyards and Winery, located in the middle of downtown Palisade at 405 West 1st Street in Palisade, Colorado. We are, like I said, we're 3.5 hours west of Denver on I-70 and approximately 4 hours east of Salt Lake, south on 15 and Highway 6 to I-70. We are at verizonvineyards.com, V-A-R-A-I-S-O-N, Vineyards, plural with an S, .com. And if you look for us on Facebook, it's facebook.com/verizonvineyards. And that's where we do the majority of our keep in touch and all of the new releases. We're actually getting ready to release a couple of new products around the 1st of March, as soon as I get labels in from the label printer out in California. I have new products in bottles that are getting ready to be released and are different even than those which I have been speaking about for the last hour or so. So I have a lot of fun stuff that's coming out on there. Watch for us on Facebook. We tag stuff on Instagram, everything that you can imagine. We are very socially networked, which makes it really easy to get a hold of us. If you ever want to talk to any of us at the winery, you can call us at area code 970-464-4928 or send us an email at info@verizonvineyards.com. And we'll be more than happy to field your questions, your requests, or anything else that we can do for you. You know, most of all, we want you to come visit us here in Western Colorado. We enjoy sharing our experiences with everyone that visits and teaching a little bit more about wine and helping the general population to feel not quite so overwhelmed about wine. It isn't as big a deal as everyone makes it out to be, but a little bit of knowledge really makes you a very educated shopper and makes you a very educated wine connoisseur and capable of impressing even the most astute sommelier in any restaurant. So we like having a lot of fun like that.
And if you order anything, be sure to mention All About Wine, because they're going to run a special for us.
Exactly. We'll run a special for you, and we can ship to a majority of state locations. You must call in order to order wine from us. It is not available online. You must call us at 970-464-4928 and mention All About Wine, and we'll run a special for you and find out if we can ship to your state location. The majority of states are okay, but there are a few that are on the list that we might need to write your senator for. So that's the easy way around it, right?
Easy. Alex, thank you so very much for taking the time this evening to talk with it. It was fascinating, interesting, very informative, and just a wonderful time. I am going to one of these days make it out to see you, because you painted such a rosy picture of Palisades and the winery in that area there that one cannot help but want to go there.
Well, we welcome you anytime that you can make it out our direction. We're open every day from 10 to 5 and every day except major holidays. Use common sense. If you're spending Christmas with your family, so are we. So this is really very straightforward. You know, we are a family business, so that means that we do occasionally take time off, but every day 10 to 5 and 10 to 6 on Friday and Saturday.
Wow. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. Yeah.
My pleasure entirely. We'll talk to you again soon.
Well, right, take care. Hope so. Take care now.
So, yeah, take care. Thank you.
Night.
Bye-bye.
Wow.
Oh. Well, that was interesting. That was fun. I expected him to be a very good guest, and he was. So, great.
Yeah. That was a lot of information. He's obviously very involved with everything, and very very interesting history and everything, and how it came to be, and there's a lot in there.
I was taking notes too, and I got a page and a half filled up here on some of the things I was interested in. So
might have to hire a third person to do all the Twitter feeds and everything like that.
Yeah, really. I mean, to keep up on some of this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that was good.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, we don't have anything.
Sunday.
Planned.
Sunday.
Oh, it's the 28th.
Class.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So coming up is on the February, where am I at? 28th. Okay.
21st. You're a week ahead of us. You're looking forward to your vacation. It's not here yet.
I am looking on the wrong week, aren't I?
Yeah.
The 18th. Okay, it's only the 18th. I don't know why that's a different day. Okay,
because you want to go down to Texas. That's why. And so you're trying to, but it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I know. It'll be here soon enough.
Yeah, well.
So you have, that's the 21st, you have wine class. Okay, good.
Correct.
Let's roll this. I'll be back in 1.5 minutes. Hopefully it's the right one. Hey, this is Mike. Coming up this Sunday at Florida State's winery from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. is another wine class. That's right. Wine class at Florida State's winery featuring winemaker, vineyardist, cellar master, and tasting expert Ron Hunt. He shares his experiences and educational knowledge of wine in a detailed 3-hour wine class. It's a lot of fun and a great way to learn something new about wine. Some of the topics that are covered include a brief history of wines, wine grape varietals, wine grape diseases, wine glass styles and uses, cork history, evolution and uses, oak aging, wine tasting and rating wines, and my favorite, of course, the sampling of wines and a discussion. It's a great presentation, and it's located in the Florida State's Winery Tasting Room. For more information and to RSVP, which we would recommend, please contact the winery at area code 813-996-2113. Again, Florida State's Winery is phone number 813-996-2113. Florida State's Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Don't forget wine class this Sunday from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at Florida State's Winery. See you there. Yes. There you go. I got to redo that one. I don't know why. There's something not right on that. yes. February 21st, this Sunday, is a wine class. And call and make sure you get on the list and all that. You want to be prepared for that. So that's awesome. It's a good time and a good 3 hours learning all about wine. So check it out. All right. I guess we will end the show for this week. And be sure to check us out on Facebook for updates and everything. Ron does post updates on the Facebook page and way ahead of in advance from what I get online, but that's okay. Just check out the Facebook, search for All About Wine BTR, I believe, on Facebook, and that'll send you to our page. Make sure it has Ron's mugshot or whatever it is on there. His mug is on there.
My mug.
Or it could be a wine glass.
Yeah. Hopefully we might have a winery from Maine next week.
Wow. That's
see
good.
If I can. I got a lead on it. We'll see if we can't get a winery from Maine.
All right. Go to the page and check it out on Facebook, and he'll let you know when that's good to go. And the show will be scheduled here on Blog Talk Radio. So check out those sources. We will see you all next week. That's Thursday, February 25th, right here at 7 p.m. to 8-something p.m. on Blog Talk Radio. And, again, special thanks to Alex West from Verazon.
Verazon.
And Winery. Verazon, yes.
Yes.
In near the Grand Junction area, Palisade, Colorado. So thank you very much again. A very, very good interview. So interview. It's like we're doing a job thing. You are your heart. All righty. We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Oh, 60 seconds.
Is it? Wow.
Yeah, they just told me 60 seconds. So
okay. I don't hear that.
We'll put the closing. And everyone, thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Yep. All right. Thanks a lot. Goodbye. Have a good one.
Bye.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery.
Florida State's Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida, 4 miles west of Interstate 75 or east of U.S. 19 and U.S. 41. For more information on Florida State's Winery, visit the website at floridaestateswines.com or call area code 813-996-2113. The email address is corp@floon.com. That's C-O-R-P at F-L-E-W-N.com. For more information on All About Wine and future shows, please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr or visit our website at allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available as a free download on iTunes and on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on All About Wine.